You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM.
Since the introduction of NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, 6 million Mexicans have gone to live in the United States. With few green cards or permanent resident visas available for Mexicans, most of these migrants were undocumented. While these workers provide valuable and much-needed labor to the American economy, they are criminalized and deprived of their economic rights. In a new book, David Bacon posits that the displacement of workers and the use of migrant labor are linked with American immigration and trade policies. David is a longtime labor activist and photographer and the author of Illegal People, How Globalization Creates Migration and Criminalizes Immigrants. He also wrote a report for the Oakland Institute called Uprooted, The Impact of the Free Market on Migrants. And David is on the line from his home in the Bay Area. Hello, David.
Hi there.
Talk to me about the title of the book, Illegal People. What's the tension behind putting those words together?
Well, I've been an immigrant rights activist for about 30 years, and we've been trying to get people all that time to use the phrase undocumented immigrants rather than talking about people, especially using illegal as a noun, like the illegals. And the reason for that is that undocumented describes kind of factually what the reality is. In other words, that people cross the border without documents. But I think that we've kind of lost that debate, and at least on this, you know, down here in the U.S., the media is just full of the use of the word illegal without, I think, any consciousness on the part of the people who are using it of what that means. Plus, it's sort of kind of demonized migrants and helped to reshape the debate on immigration and kind of provide a rationale or a justification for the criminalization of migrants. But I think that one reason why the word has become current also is that illegal describes something that's real, and that is it describes the kind of social inequality and the rightlessness that's the situation and the predicament of millions and millions of migrants here in the U.S. And I would also say that this is true in Canada as well, too. It's not happening in Canada at the same speed and with the same ferocity that is happening down here. But it's happening. In fact, I would say this is happening all over the world. You know, Manu Chao, the singer, wrote this song that's called Clandestino. And when I first heard the song, I thought the song was talking about people coming from Mexico to the U.S. And then I listened closely, and it was talking about people coming from Morocco to Spain, you know, and it was talking about Ceuta and Gibraltar. And the way he uses the word clandestino is really almost exactly the same as the way people use the word illegal here. So I guess what I'm trying to say here is that, first of all, we have to take a look at the reality of what's actually happening to migrants in the world. And secondly, if we don't like what this reality is, if we don't like the inequality and the idea that people are denied basic political and social and economic rights, then we have to actually change the reality. And simply renaming it doesn't change it. We have to actually have social movements that change what exists in real life.
As a photographer, you've documented the lives of many of these workers, and the book tells some of their stories. Why is it important to hear these stories, to look at that situation on the ground?
Well, again, this is what I call the reality check. First of all, the criminalization of people and the demonization of people is a lot easier if you don't actually hear what people have to say and, you know, kind of appreciate the all of the aspects of the humanity of, in this case, migrants. You know, migrants coming to the U.S. and to Canada from, you know, Mexico and Central America and the Caribbean, for instance, are bringing with them very often a very rich culture, especially indigenous people. You know, dances, food, music, social organizations, people's ability to get themselves together and to change their situation. And so I think that we need to appreciate these things because they are changing our culture on the north side of the border here, in the case of the U.S. and Mexico and in Canada as well, too. And they're making our culture a much more rich and diverse ones. So I think, first of all, it's important just to appreciate human beings, but also it's important for us to listen to what people have to say about how they see the causes of their own displacement and migration, kind of what pushed them into migration to begin with, and how people themselves see the solution to it. So I'll give you an example. I was in Oaxaca this last year at a conference of indigenous organizations, and people were talking about what they called el derecho de no migrar, which means the right to not migrate. And what they meant was that in Oaxaca, there should be some economic alternative to migration. In other words, some way in which people can earn a living as farmers or have jobs as workers that provide a future and a decent life for people there, so that people don't, especially young people, don't see coming to the U.S. and to Canada as being the only way of supporting their families and the only way of progressing economically. That people ought to be able to make a choice. There should be some options for people. And I think that that's something that we hear if we pay attention to what people have to say for themselves and what people on the ground are actually, how they actually see their lives.
Well, one of the central themes in the book is that U.S. trade and immigration policy are linked together. How do you see that dynamic in terms of displacement and migration?
Well, to put it real simply, you know, trade agreements like NAFTA and structural adjustment policies in Mexico and Central America make people poor. You know, these are agreements that are designed to boost corporate profits and to, you know, allow the free movement of capital and corporations, but at the very same time, what they do is they increase poverty by allowing big grain companies, for instance, to flood the Mexican market with cheap corn so that farmers can't even get a price for corn that'll pay for the cost of growing it, or rob workers of their jobs in auto parts plants because the big auto assemblers no longer buy parts from Mexican producers anymore. All of these things displace people. And this is actually part of the purpose of these agreements. It's not spoken openly because it's kind of politically unacceptable to say that, but it's true. You know, one of the main intentions of these agreements is to produce displaced people because the economies of Canada and the United States are dependent on that labor. Without the labor of immigrants, our economies would suffer greatly. In fact, you could say that they pretty much couldn't function at all. So this labor is very necessary, and these agreements help to produce it. And then what happens is that immigration policy steps in and regulates that labor so that it gets supplied to the employers that want to use it at the price that they want to pay. In other words, it supplies vulnerable labor at a very low cost. So there are a lot of ways in which immigration policy does that. Here in the United States, you know, we have the fact that we have 12 million people who can't get legal status. And because they don't have legal status, it's very easy for employers to threaten them and to use that to push their labor down. In Canada, especially in agriculture, there are very extensive guest worker programs in which, British Columbia, there was the case in September of workers at a nursery who tried to join a union and who were then deported from Canada about a week, I think, before they were supposed to vote in a union election. So basically, those kinds of immigration policies or the system by which people kind of like come into the countries is used to, on the one hand, supply labor to employers who want to use it, but also to give employers a lot of leverage over those workers so that they can ensure that that labor is as cheap as possible.
In the book, you have a section called How the Corporations Won the Debate on Immigration Reform. Can you sketch out that story for us?
Well, here in the U.S., we had proposals going back to the late 90s in the Clinton administration from corporations to revamp U.S. immigration policy to expand very greatly guest worker programs. And by guest worker programs, what I'm talking about are those programs which allow corporations and contractors to go to countries like Mexico or Guatemala and then recruit people and bring them across the border with temporary visas that say that if those people don't work, they have to leave, so you're sort of tied to your job. You don't have a family, you don't settle down in any community, you certainly can't exercise any kind of political rights, you're just there to work and only to work. So these are the kinds of labor programs, increasingly, that corporations want. And in the U.S., we had proposals from some of the largest corporations, you know, 40 of the biggest manufacturing associations in the world, really, got together and they formed this coalition called the Essential Worker Immigration Coalition, and they went to Congress and they began making proposals for these kinds of programs. And along with the guest worker programs, they were also proposing increased enforcement as a way of kind of forcing workers to only come through those programs, and a certain kind of legalization program so that for employers who had a lot of undocumented workers in their workforce, they could kind of grandfather those workers in and the employers wouldn't be liable for having employed them to begin with. And those, you know, those bills were actually talked about in the media here as being kind of pro-immigrant bills. In fact, the whole reason why John McCain, the Republican presidential candidate, is being called a pro-immigrant candidate is because he sponsored one of those bills, which was actually called the McCain-Kennedy bill. But these were not really bills that were proposed to benefit immigrants or to benefit workers. These were bills that were written by corporations, and they kind of came to dominate the debate here in the United States over immigration reform. You know, they were called like the only politically reasonable and realistic kinds of bills that we could get Congress to pass. So people on the left, especially in the U.S., who had ideas about much more pro-immigrant, much more pro-worker kinds of bills, we were kind of shut out of the debate by these big corporate immigration proposals.
We saw during that time huge popular demonstrations in 2005 against that regressive legislation on immigrant workers. What, looking back on that 3 years later, are we still seeing effects of those popular that popular opposition?
Yes, we certainly are. I think that those demonstrations were a sort of the beginning of a process in which immigrant communities in the U.S. have become much more politically active and much more politically sophisticated. So they sort of began a learning process, which I think is very important here. And that's sort of, if anything is going to get us a pro-immigrant, you know, immigration reform in the U.S., that's one of the main elements for it. So I think that that was very positive. And also I think that this is sort of an example of how the culture of migration helps to kind of renovate our culture, at least here in the United States, because these demonstrations were taking place on May Day. And here in the U.S., even though May Day was born in Chicago in the struggle for the eight-hour day, we stopped celebrating May Day here after World War II during the Cold War because it was called the Red Holiday or the Communist Holiday. And so everybody else, including in Canada, were celebrating May Day, and here in the U.S., we didn't celebrate it. And so these demonstrations by immigrants, they called for these huge marches on May Day, in part because that was the day that people were used to having kind of working class demonstrations in the countries that they came from. So it was sort of a natural thing for people to do. And since those marches and demonstrations began, we've now had 3 years in which we have marches and demonstrations with literally hundreds of thousands of people out in the street. And I think that it's helped us as a country and as a culture to recover a kind of working class tradition that we'd lost. So I feel very positive about, you know, what happened in those marches, and I think that they're going to continue.
You propose an idea in the book, an equation that points to a way forward. Blacks plus immigrants plus unions equal power. What, in your view, are the challenges to making that happen?
Well, what we're talking about here is trying to find a common ground in which we have proposals that will advance the needs of kind of all working class people. So on the one hand, We need immigration reform that reinforces the rights of migrants, things like legalization for people who don't have legal status, an end to sort of the exploitive guest worker programs, more emphasis on family reunification here, the ability of people to reunite their families, and rights for people not to have their immigration status used against them. We have a law in the U.S., for instance, that makes it illegal for somebody to work if they don't have immigration papers. So we need that kind of immigration reform, but we can't get it as just sort of like a standalone set of proposals. We have to sort of link it to other kinds of proposals that are going to help other sections of the working class communities in our country here. So, for instance, we have 6.8% unemployment right now in the United States. We need a jobs program. We need the federal government to guarantee that anybody who wants to work will go to work. And if the private sector can't supply that, those jobs, then the public sector has to step in and do that, like in the New Deal. So we need a jobs program. We need also to kind of reinforce the organizing rights of workers in general. Canada has a very, very good system for organizing unions here, one that union members in the U.S. are very envious of. And so we have proposals in Congress now to kind of bring our labor law much more in line with what Canada has. A proposal is called the Employee Free Choice Act. So if we had that as part of our law down here, not only would the rights of all workers to organize unions be kind of reinforced, but it would help immigrants to sort of organize and end their use as being kind of a source of cheap labor for corporations. So the idea is that we need to kind of combine all of these things together and sort of have a common ground set of proposals that would meet the needs of a lot of the diverse sections of our working class communities here.
Well, I really appreciate your talking with me this morning, David.
It's my pleasure.
Bye now.
Bye.
I've been speaking with David Bake, and David is a longtime labor activist and photographer and the author of Illegal People, How Globalization Creates Migration and Criminalizes Immigrants. It's published by Beacon Press. He also wrote a report for the Oakland Institute called Uprooted, The Impact of Free Market on Migrants. It's available at oaklandinstitute.org.